Okay, well, why don't we get started then, and we'll just go through each question, and if you have any related questions, we'll stop. If not, we'll just keep going through question by question. Okay, so the first two are looking at, the first four, actually, are questions of general knowledge. So in terms of the first question, in a multiple linear regression, so we know this is asking about a multiple linear regression with n observations and p covariates, the residual, meaning that's what residual means. So residual, another word for that is unexplained or error. The residual population variance. So this was a key because the word was population variance, which we know if we think of Greek symbols is sigma squared. Right, the residual population variance in the outcome is estimated by what? So is it estimated by the sum of the squared residuals divided by its degrees of freedom and minus p minus 1? So that answer is false. Is it estimated by the total sums of squares, SST, divided by n minus 1? So we know that that was the old sample variance, S squared, that didn't take into account the regression, so that is false. Is it 1 minus r squared? Now, this wasn't meant to be the answer, and we know that a number of people answered this as 1 minus r squared. So the question is, why is it not 1 minus r squared? So just by looking at some expressions right now, 1 minus r squared is looking at 1 minus the sums of squares for the regression over the total sums of squares. So when we talked about this being the proportion of variability in the outcome, y, that's not explained or unexplained by the linear regression, it's a fraction. So we know that this is a fraction that goes between 0 and 1. What we were looking for is the residual population variance, which another term for that residual population variance is the MSE, which would have been taking the SSE divided by its degrees of freedom. So do we see this anywhere? So, in fact, I think you let me get away with the fact that the first one was the correct one. So I mislabeled this. Long day. Let's go back. Let's look at the first one. Long day for all of us, right? So I was looking at this, and very quickly, I was looking at sums of squared residuals, and how was I reading it incorrectly? I was reading it as the sums of the squares for the regression, the SSR. So this was my error, but this is probably a good, a good illustration of reading too quickly. So I read too quickly, and if I read not too quickly, I would know that the sums of squares, I've just frozen the computer now. Sure. So why don't we look at the formula sheet? So I'm trying to close my computer so I can reboot it. But why don't we all turn to the formula sheet at the back? So when we have a simple linear regression, we know that with a simple linear regression on the last page, that when we are splitting the total sums of squares into two components, the degrees of freedom are going to be equal to the number of predictors. So in this case, for a simple linear regression, it's 1. And then the residual will equal n minus 2. So it's taking what is the predictor, where p is the number of predictors, 1. It's taking n minus p minus 1. So that's where that that formula comes from when it's expanded to a multiple linear regression. So I am looking at your last page of the formula sheet right now. And the last page of the formula sheet is only looking at simple linear regression, but you'd have to take this in combination with knowing that we expanded this from simple linear regression to multiple linear regression, that the degrees of freedom in that column that correspond to residuals as well as the regression, residuals in total, will all depend on the number of predictors in the model. So I think my computer's coming back now. I'm going to try to get it rebooted. But just in terms of, you know, the question about degrees of freedom, if P is the predictor, then, okay, so we'll just have to just be patient for a second. If we all looked at that last page of the formula sheet, then how would this translate into a multiple linear regression? For the regression, the degrees of freedom would be P. The total degrees of freedom always is N minus 1. Always N minus 1. So if we're looking at the residuals, then that residual would be N minus 1 minus P, the number of predictors. But it wasn't so much the degrees of freedom in this question as it was how are we quantifying that residual variability. And it would come from the sums of squares for the regression. So when my computer comes back up, I think what we'll do is we'll write out what that ANOVA table is for regression so we can look at the source of the variability, the degrees of freedom, and the mean square that are associated with each. So my computer froze because I was trying something a little bit different right now. And that's because there were some people who wanted to be able to attend this but couldn't. So I'm going through a little bit of special recording, and I'm not sure this is going to work, but we're going to try it one more time. And if it freezes again, we're not going to try it. We'll give up. First question. So let us start by actually drawing what we know would be the ANOVA table for the regression. So the source is that we're splitting the total variability into two components, the regression and the residual. And when we talk about the sums of squares, this is the SSR for the regression and the SSE for the residuals and the SST for the total. When we look at degrees of freedom, when we had a simple linear regression, we just had P equals 1 covariate. But if we said that this is P as the number of covariates, and if what is the total degrees of freedom for the that goes along with the SST? Total degrees of freedom is always N minus 1. So that means that the residual is N minus P minus 1. Now, this was not the important part of this question, so I won't get hung up on the degrees of freedom here, but this is what the degrees of freedom split into to add to N minus 1. So then we looked at that last column, which was the mean square, and we said, what's a mean square? A mean square takes the sums of squares divided by the appropriate degrees of freedom, so that the mean square for regression takes the sums of squares for the regression over its degrees of freedom. And I could just call it DF for degrees of freedom, but it is P. The mean square is going to take the mean square for error takes the sums of squares for error divided by its degrees of freedom. I'm just going to label it as degrees of freedom. And then that last one, if we had ignored the covariates, SST divided by N minus 1 was just the estimate of variance S squared that's based on the entire data set, ignoring all the covariates. So back to this example number 1. In a multiple linear regression with n observations and p covariates, the residual or unexplained population variance should have keyed into us that the residual variance, the estimate of sigma squared, after you account for the linear relationship between y and all of these different covariates, is going to be the MSE. This was what we were looking for. Residual variance means the MSE. So If we go through these, I'm going to now go from the bottom up on this page so that we can start with E. So the sums of squares for the regression over whatever its degrees of freedom are is not the mean square for error. That's the mean square for regression. So E is false. The sums of squared residuals divided by the total sums of squares. So I'm not going to write that as, in the numerator, that's the SSE over the SST. This is a proportion. So it's a number that goes between 0 and 1. And we would say the SSE over the SST is the proportion of variability not explained by the linear relationship with covariates. Does that make sense to everyone? It's not going to be an estimate of population variance. Population variance is when we say, let's look at the relationship between Y and one or more variables. And the sum of this spread in Y is due to the fact that as X1 increases, Y increases, or as X2 increases, Y increases. So when we talk about residual variance, we're saying fixing the values of all those other variables, the residual variance is the leftover, the unexplained variance. And we estimate it. The standard deviation is estimated by the square root of the MSE. The variance is estimated by the MSE itself. So D is false because it's not the SSE over SST. This is what we would know as 1 minus R squared. And 1 minus R squared is actually another answer, which is C. So it's given twice, and that would be false. The total sums of squares, SST over N minus 1, that would have been, if we had looked at all of the Y variables about their mean, we would have had much more variability then, using the estimate of the sample variance, than what we get with the residual variance. So that would be false. And then A said sums of squares for residuals, the SSE, over N minus P minus 1. So even if we say, well, I'm not sure about where that P came in, we know that there were P covariates. And so the estimate of the variance, residual variance, is the MSE, so it has to have that SSE in the numerator. Bhakti? So what I'm actually saying is that you didn't need to know the degrees of freedom. What we did was we did go into beginning multiple linear regression last term. We went from having one covariate to actually having two, and then we had an interaction term giving us three covariates. Maybe we didn't highlight so much the fact, but we always said that when we talked, even with the simple linear regression, the degrees of freedom for the regression is the number of covariates. So with a simple linear regression, P is equal to 1. If you have a multiple linear regression with P covariates, the degrees of freedom would be equal to P. But I'm going to play devil's advocate just for another moment and say, even if you got confused by the degrees of freedom, it's not going to have the SST in the numerator. It's not going to have the SS for regression in the numerator. And it's not going to be R squared or 1 minus R squared because we're asking for variance, not for a proportion of variability that's not explained. Does that help? So if we move on then to number 2, we're back to a simple linear regression analysis with one covariate. So one covariate. And the F-test from the ANOVA for that regression may be used to test what null hypothesis. So we'll recall back that when we have just one covariate, our model is just the expected Y equals beta naught plus beta 1 times that one covariate. And what's of interest to us is beta 1. And the way we can assess whether beta 1 equals 0 is one of three ways, just in terms of a review. One way is to use the t-test from the output, but our question is asking, what do you see from the f-test of the ANOVA? And so actually, remember in the right-hand corner, there's an f-test, which is giving us also a test of the null hypothesis that beta 1 equals 0, and as well, we could look at the 95% confidence interval for beta 1. But it's asking us about this F-test. What is it testing? It's testing a hypothesis that beta 1, the change in expected y with x, equals 0. So does it test that the population mean equals 0? That would be a hypothesis like mu equals 0. That's false. That the population standard deviation sigma equals 0, is it doing that? False. That the population correlation coefficient, meaning rho, equals 0, that's false. That the covariate of interest contributes to explaining the variation in the outcome, or does it test the null hypothesis that the covariate of interest does not contribute to the explanation of variation in the outcome? So remember, if beta 1 is equal to 0, what does it tell us about the relationship between y and x? It says x tells us nothing about what the value of y will be. So the answer we were looking for is E. In English, the null hypothesis that beta 1 equals 0 is that the covariate of interest does not contribute to explaining the variation in the outcome. Number three, suppose that the total sample size required to detect a difference delta between two groups was estimated as n, assuming equal sample sizes in both groups. So now, keeping all other assumptions the same, the sample size required to detect a difference two times that would equal what? So why don't we talk about this in terms of the old n and the new n, shall we? So the old n is going to be some value that's going to depend on, and so we may as well look at the back of the formula page just to remind ourselves about sample size calculations. And in fact, we're not even told whether this is continuous or dichotomous. But it doesn't really matter, because if you look at the formulas will have something that relies on, in the numerator, that relies on alpha and beta, and either the standard deviation or the p. Do you want to go look at those sample size formulas here? You can look at them. I'm going to have to flip back to look at them. So we're in number 3 here, so I'm just going slowly, flipping back to the formula page. Okay, so after a few other things, we finally reach the formula page. Oh so slowly we find it. So here's one sample size calculation, and we can see that what we're being told is that nothing in this numerator, if it was proportions, nothing in the numerator is changing. What is changing is the delta in the denominator. Or if we were looking at means, up on the right-hand side of probably the middle of the page for you, you can see if we had a difference in means, the numerator is what we're saying assumed to be fixed, and delta is what's changing. So that means the only focus we have to really care about is the denominator. So let's go back to number 3 and say, for the old sample size to detect a difference of delta, we'll say the old sample size is based on detecting delta, but in those formulas it's expressed as delta squared. And so the new sample size now is one in which we want to be able to detect 2 delta. So our only real goal is to recognize that it's a square in that denominator. So our numerator stays the same. In the denominator, we have 4 times delta squared. I'm just squaring 2 delta to make it 4 times delta squared. And if we express that in terms of the old sample size, this would be 1/4 of what we saw before, the old n, which was equal to the numerator divided by delta squared. Are you with me? So because it's a square, the new sample size is going to be the same as the old sample size, but divided by 4. So the answer was E. Yeah? So the recognition is that this delta is in a squared term. So it's not going to be two times as, you know, two time or half that amount. It's going to be a fourth of what the original sample size was. Okay, so how about number four? Suppose an analysis of variance was performed to compare mean responses among P equals 5 groups in a study with 100 individuals. In a post hoc comparison of means, making all possible pairwise comparisons. So what that says to us is that this will be P choose 2, which for us is 5 choose 2, which is, so we'd say let's see if we can expand this. So with a little bit of subtraction, we would see that this is 10 possible pairwise comparisons. So if we use a Bonferroni-corrected per test, meaning we're using that significance level for each pairwise test, what is the corrected level that would give us an overall type 1 probability of 0.05 or something less? So if this is equal to 10, our Bonferroni correction was looking at alpha divided by p choose 2, which would be 0.05 divided by 10. So we were looking for the answer that the Bonferroni corrected alpha is equal to 0.005. And that answer would have been C. Make sense to everybody? Okay, we'll move on to number 5 through 11. So 5 through 11 says this pertains to a study of 389 individuals who were screened for diabetes from a study of prevalence of diabetes, obesity, and other cardiovascular risk factors for African Americans. We're told that the outcome of interest is actually dichotomous, one for diagnosis of diabetes based on a hemoglobin A1C level, zero for no diagnosis, and then we have some covariates of interest. And we just notice how gender is coded, zero for male, one for female, age is dichotomized, zero for less than 45, one for 45 or older, and then we have a waist-to-hip ratio measured in centimeters, and we told we have some data we can explore at the end of the exam. So on number 5, it says, suppose a chi-square test was used to test the null hypothesis of no association between this dichotomous diabetes and dichotomous age. And we're told from table 1, the chi-squared statistic is 43.36 with 1 degree of freedom. So let's look at the table. I had brought the table in. Do you want to just go to the back of your exam and look at the table? So table 1 is given here, and we just see diabetes, no, yes, young versus old. We're able to see that if you look in and inspect the data, that the proportion who are in the oldest age group is actually 84% among those who have diabetes and 43% among those who don't. And that's because we're given here the column percentages, but of course we could have looked at the row percentages as well. But here's the chi-squared statistic. We're told the probability is equal to zero. And just a reminder, the critical value for a chi-squared with 1 degree of freedom and alpha of 0.05 is 3.84. And that was given on the formula page, the chi-square value. Do you want to look at it? So in the formula page, at the very back of the formula page, you had some probabilities, and you had a little note here that said, a Z value of 1.96 that corresponds to a two-sided alpha of 0.05 is the same as a chi-square value of 3.84. So that value of 41 far exceeds 3.84. So we'd say there's a statistically significant association, but now we have to ask which of those responses is in the correct direction. And so tell me if you want to spend more or less time on it, but we looked at the data. And we'll go on then to look at this question that says no statistically significant difference. So I'd say right away we could get rid of this response because there is a statistically significant difference. The next one also says no statistically significant difference, so I would get rid of this one. The last three say statistically significant something. So we have to say, what is it showing? So is it showing a statistically significant higher proportion with diabetes in individuals less than 45 compared to individuals 45 or older? Or is it talking about a statistically significant higher odds of diabetes in one group versus the other? So let's see what we can glean. So we had that table. And so somebody tell me, because I actually only have the table at the end of the exam, what can you say with respect to the association between diabetes and age, based on looking at the table that you're reviewing? So here's young age, older ages. We had 180, and then we had 12 in the younger groups. The first group didn't have diabetes, the second group does. Then we had 134 as well as 63, and the totals were 314, 75, 192, 197, and 389. Okay. So maybe we should just have used our calculators to do a little quick math. So because it's asking, is there a higher proportion with diabetes in individuals that are less than 45? So we look straight away, the proportion who have diabetes is 12 over 197 compared to, sorry, it's 192, right? 12 over 192 compared to, just eyeballing it, 63 over 197. So is there a higher proportion in older or in younger?
Older.
Older. So this would be false. Now the next two are asking you, what are the odds? Are the odds higher in older individuals or are they higher in younger individuals? So then we can look at the odds. So what are the odds of diabetes in older, in younger individuals? The odds are 12 over 180. In older individuals, it's 63 over 134. And so if we wanted to just make sure of this, we could do a little bit of calculation, and we would see the odds are about 0.067 in the younger group, and the odds are about 0.47. So we're seeing the odds are much higher. The odds of diabetes are much higher in the older age group than in the younger age group. So I would go with D, higher odds of diabetes in older individuals as compared to younger individuals. So we actually had to do a little bit of thought process on this because of the fact that what we were given were the column percentages instead of the row percentages. Yes. So what we're told here is that this is a study of screening. So it's really a cross-sectional study. So what we can do is we can either talk about the percentages in those groups or we can more accurately talk about the odds. But if we wanted to look at risk ratio, this would not necessarily be the most appropriate measure of association. So we were, you know, either asking here about odds or differences in proportions. Okay, so moving on to number six, it says, suppose we use the data in table one that we can go back to in just a second to fit a simple logistic regression of diabetes regressed on dichotomous age such that we had this model. The log odds of diabetes equals beta naught plus beta one age 45. So in this model, e to the beta one is estimated by what? So this meant that we had to be able to interpret what beta 1 is. So we know beta 1 is a log odds ratio. But then we have to ask, what is that odds ratio, right? Beta 1 is a log odds ratio. So it's going to be the odds of the outcome, which is diabetes. the odds of diabetes, in the group in which, remember how age was categorized? Age 45 was taking 1 for older group and 0 for the younger group. So we're looking at beta 1 as being the log of the odds of diabetes in the older age group divided by the odds of diabetes in the younger age group. In other words, why are we saying it's a log odds ratio? It's because it's a difference between two log odds. And what we would have to do then is go back and say, we actually looked at this before. What are the odds of diabetes in the older age group? About 0.47. What are the odds of diabetes in the younger age group? About 0.067. And so if we want to get at e to the beta 1, then what we can do is exponentiate both sides, forget about the log, and just take this ratio of 0.47 to reduce it. But in fact, I've gone too far, haven't I? Because we already did this already. We said it's going to be 63 divided by 134 over 12 divided by 180. Do we see that anywhere here? I think we see it in B. Okay. So the next one, number 7, is try to mix and match these links. And so for these data, suppose we have a generalized linear model such that the linear function of predictors on the right-hand side is beta naught plus beta 1 gender plus beta 2 times the dichotomous age variable. So match the link function with the regression coefficients and its interpretation, and you may use these more than once. Okay, so let's look down first and say, if you're looking at beta 1 that gives you a log odds ratio interpretation, then that right away tells us that this is going to be a Loget link. So the answer here would have been C. If you have a log risk ratio, this would have been a link log, which is B. If you had a log odds ratio, now it's just for a different variable fixing the other one, this would also be C, the Loget. The risk difference for diabetes, so risk difference always in our mind came up with identity link, yes, which is A. And then lastly, a log risk ratio, and it says for gender by diabetes fixing age. What's the matter with this one? So the outcome is not gender. The outcome is diabetes. The covariate is gender. So this one was none of the above. None of the above. This would have been an appropriate one if we were looking at a model that was looking at the outcome being gender, and our model was beta naught plus beta 1 diabetes plus beta 2 times age. But we're told that the model is given up above for all of them. Okay, move on. Number 8. So we have some models to compare. From a comparison of models A and model B, we'll take a quick glance and we'll say that we see some terms here. And the terms are, does age confound an association? Does it modify an association? Does gender confound or modify? So the wording we're trying to look at is, let's go and look at models A and B and see if we can assess either confounding or effect modification. So after table 1 comes model A. So we are again reminded of how we've coded these. So in model A, it's just a simple logistic regression in which we're looking at the log odds of diabetes as a function of age. And we'll inspect that age coefficient. Looks like the age coefficient B1 is about 1.95. Then we went to model B, and we've added in another covariate, gender, and we'll inspect now the age coefficient. So we have two coefficients and an intercept. And the age coefficient remains about 1.95. So when you have model A and then you add another variable, model B, what we can do is assess whether gender potentially confounds the relationship between age and the log odds of diabetes. And since these coefficients remain the same, I would say it looks like there's no substantial confounding. Now, what about effect modification? Can we even assess effect modification from these two models? No, and why not? We would need to have the interaction term of age and gender in the model. Now, we will have an interaction term eventually of something, but we never see the interaction term of age and gender in the models that are given. Bakhtin. Right, so to assess confounding, when we say substantial change, a guideline, a rough guideline, is to say, does the coefficient in the multiple linear regression change by 15% or more, either positive or negative, compared to what you saw in the simple, you know, linear or logistic regression? So I think that means we can go back to number 8, and we can say all of these responses that are talking about modification are incorrect. So now we want to differentiate between, can we talk about age being a confounder of the association between gender and diabetes, or can we talk about gender not being a confounder of the relationship between age and diabetes? And what we just said was that gender did not seem to substantially confound this relationship between age and diabetes, because the age coefficient from simple linear regression was about the same as the age coefficient from the multiple linear regression. And would you be able to say anything about age being a confounder from the models that you're given? You would have needed to have a model in which you were looking at the log odds first as a function of gender, and then you'd have to have another model which is adding in age. So you'd have beta naught plus beta 1 gender plus beta 2 times age, so that you could assess whether age is influencing the relationship between gender and diabetes. And we don't have those models to make those comparisons. Yes. That's right. So we can't assess effect modification or interaction in models A versus B because we're not including an interaction term, right? We'd have to be able to have a model with an interaction term multiplying age times gender in order to say anything about possible effect modification. Yes. Sure. So let's look at it this way. So one way to look at it is if we were to think of a simple linear regression. So with a simple linear regression, if we're looking at the log odds of an outcome and we're looking at the relationship with age, we might see that there's this positive relationship. If we have a multiple linear regression and we bring in another factor such as gender, if there is confounding, I'm going to make this very, very apparent. It doesn't need to be this dramatic. But if I brought in gender and I saw that the coefficient that's referring to the relationship between the log odds of diabetes and age substantially changed, then that would be possible evidence of confounding. I'd have to assess whether the second variable was associated with the outcome and the second variable was associated with the first variable. But visually, if I saw a different relationship after I stratified by the level of the second covariate, and do you notice how these are very parallel lines? This would suggest confounding. But what would be different then if I actually brought in an interaction term for an ANCOVA? So with an interaction term in there, we're able to look at the relationship between log odds of disease and age by gender, but also ask the question, is that relationship different by gender? So we'd have two possible different lines where males and females have different disease age slopes, but we'd only be able to look at this if we brought in the interaction term. Is everybody comfortable with that? So in other words, we look across at these top two graphs. That allows us to assess confounding. What we've done is we have a simple linear regression just with age, a multiple linear regression that just has age and gender added into it. The ANCOVA is going to be a model that looks like this. Log odds of disease equals beta naught plus beta 1 age plus beta 2 gender. And what's the last term? Plus beta 3 age times gender. But unless we bring in that interaction term, there's no way we can have non-parallel slopes. They're always going to be parallel unless we bring in an interaction term to describe it. Yeah.
Do we know that it's confounding because one is a positive relationship?
No. So the example, I gave this as a very dramatic example. And so the guideline that we did use is that there's a substantial change, but substantial means, you know, 15%, 20%, but it doesn't need to change in direction. I was just using that as a very dramatic example of confounding. Okay, does that help? So number 9 asks us then to look at a different model, Model C, where we are told that the estimated odds ratio for disease for males, we want to know the estimated odds ratio for diabetes for males with waist-hip ratio equal to 0.9 as compared to females with waist-hip ratio equal to 0.7, adjusting for age. So I think we need to go and look at Model C. And you can turn the page and look at Model C. But Model C is looking at log odds equals, I'll call it B0 for the estimate, plus B1 times age, 45, plus B2 times gender, plus B1 times this weight-height ratio. And I think the very first thing we can do is say that's our model. So now we're asked, look at the odds ratio for somebody who is male, who has a waist-hip ratio equal to 0.9, compared to a female with a waist-hip ratio that's equal to 0.7, but we're told that we're adjusting for age. So what does that mean about their age? Their age is the same. Their age is the same. So let's use our estimates here. So from Model C, the constant was equal to negative. So in fact, let's keep writing it out because we don't have to. So we'd have B0 plus B1 times the same age for this person, plus B2. Now, gender. How is gender coded for males? Look back. So it's 0 for males, and then beta, and then B3, the estimate of beta 3, is going to be multiplied by 0.9 because the waist-hip ratio in that male is 0.9. And so now let's look at females. It'll be B0 plus B1 times the same age. Are you all with me? Plus B2 times 1 for a female, plus B3 times 0.7 for that female. Okay. So first of all, we know that if we subtract these, we get a difference in two log odds, a difference in two log odds, which is the same as a log odds ratio. So let's do some subtraction. The beta naughts cancel out. Beta 1 times age cancels out. Beta 2, B2 times 0 is just 0. So what is this going to give us? B3 times 0.9 minus, what else are we subtracting? B2 minus B3 times 0.7. All that I've done is I've just subtracted the top one, which is males with waist-hip ratio equal to 0.9 minus the log odds for females with waist-hip ratio equal to 0.7. And I think now we can just do a little bit of manipulation. So we have B3 times 0.9 minus 0.7, so that on a good day is 0.2. And then we'll subtract B2. So far, so good. We just have a little bit more to do. What's the estimate of B3? What's the estimated beta 3? So 3.73, isn't it? 3.73 times 0.2. And then we're going to subtract the estimated beta 2, which is about 0.1163. Have to go through a little calculation here. Not much, just a little. But we do need our calculator. So if you do that, 3.73 times 0.2, and then subtract 0.163. Does everybody get about 0.583? But that's a log odds ratio. And what is this asking for? The odds ratio. So how do we get that? By exponentiating 0.583, and what we should get is something that's about 1.79. Yeah? Don't all look so happy. It's okay. Does that make sense? Okay. On to 10. Okay. So on 10, it's saying, what's the predicted probability? So we know this is going to be a P for a probability of diabetes for a 55-year-old female with waist-to-hip ratio equal to 0.65. So we know that age 45 is going to be equal to 1 because this is an older individual, not that old, but an older individual. Gender is going to be equal to 1 for female, and the waist-hip ratio is equal to 0.65. And so the question is, how do we go about solving for this this P, this predicted probability of diabetes? So what do we know about that model? So we know that the model was the log odds is equal to some linear function. So I'm just going to say, let's call it a box, a linear function. What are the odds? The odds are P over Q. So that's equal to that function on the right-hand side. What is Q? Q is just the same as 1 minus P. Okay, so the log of P over 1 minus P equals the straight line relationship on the right-hand side. How do we get rid of the log? We exponentiate. So we'll get rid of the log by exponentiating both sides. So now we have P over 1 minus P equals E to the straight line relationship. And then this is, we still have to go through a little bit more to solve for P, but not too much. So let's multiply both sides by 1 minus P. Then we could write P equals 1 minus P times E to this straight line equation. Almost there. So then if we multiply 1 minus P times E to the straight line equation, we're able to write this as E to that equation minus P to that. Okay. So now what do we have? Sorry. Okay, sorry. I'm having a brain freeze. So what would you do now? You don't know what you would do yet? Okay, let's look here. Happy? I'm happy with P over Q, which is P over 1 minus P equals E to this straight line equation. Okay. Somebody else want to give me some tips now on what we would do to solve for P? Because all that we want to do is be able to express it as one of these. So if you've gotten this far, we can certainly rule out a number of these, can't we? So I would say even if you've gotten this far, we can rule out A, we can rule out B, we can rule out C. So now we're set, we're looking at D and E. And what do you notice as being the difference between D and E? Just as a process of elimination. So we have a 55-year-old individual, but how was age coded? Age was coded as a 1 or 0. And we have, right? So we're not going to have the 1 with 55 in it. So even if we didn't go through all the steps of solving this, we would find that it would have to be D. Because we have here a straight line equation that is referring to the weight-hip ratio of 0.65. We know gender and age are both being coded as 1, and we can go back to model C and look at the coefficients that were estimated for beta 1 and beta 2 and beta 3. Question? Exponentiate.
Right, that first equation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What would you get?
So if we exponentiated the log odds, what we would get is exactly the same thing here in terms of if you exponentiated log odds, you would get E. So we would find that we would just be able to say that the odds, so if E to the log of something, this would just be the odds, is E to this linear function. And so that's the same as saying, what are the odds? It's P over Q equals the linear function. And then P over Q is the same as P over 1 minus P. And then we could either go through the steps of solving for P, or I think it's probably easier to have gone through the process of elimination that we just did, to say none of these straight exponential forms will be it. It's going to be something that's solving for P over 1 minus P, solving for P from that odds, P over 1 minus P. So I'm going to bet on D as being the one. And the reason, again, E has this 55 stuck in, and we know it was a 55-year-old, but age is not continuous in this model. Age is not continuous. Okay, so now we're on to looking at model D, which does have an interaction term, and we're asking what the interpretation of this exponentiated coefficient E to the beta 4 would be interpreted as. So we do have to go to model D, and I think we could just write it out here to say that it's the log odds of diabetes. It has a number of different variables in it. So it's beta naught plus beta 1 times age 45 plus beta 2 times gender plus, again, beta 3 times the weight-height ratio. But we lastly have beta 4, which is going to be the interaction of age and weight-height ratio. So it's the interaction of these two variables, age and weight-height ratio. So first of all, we know that that beta four, which is the interaction coefficient, is not going to be a log of an odds ratio. It's the log of a ratio of two odds ratios. Now you don't need to memorize that. We could define this by going back to the model. And the beta 4 as an interaction coefficient is going to be looking at a difference in a difference. So if you recall when we looked at a continuous outcome with a linear regression and then an ANCOVA, the interaction coefficient was a difference between two slopes. Do you remember that? And this one now is not a continuous outcome, it's a dichotomous outcome. So if you think of the y-axis being the log odds, and we have weight-height ratio as being the continuous variable, we're controlling for gender. That's all we're doing is controlling for it. We're fixing it. So when we are looking at that interaction term, we're able to say we have two possible relationships that talk about the change in log odds per unit increase in weight-height ratio. One that will be for the older individuals where age 45 equals 1, and one that will be for the younger individuals where age 45 is equal to 0. So take me along with the steps of looking at this model and trying to say, let's look at those who have younger ages. Should we go through that step to make sense of why I'm saying that beta 4 is a log of a ratio of two odds ratios? So is this something everybody wants to do? So let's look at the younger people where age 45 is equal to 0. And remember, gender is just fixed. So when age 45 is equal to 0, and I'm going to change the pen color so I'm just looking at red. When it's equal to 0, beta 4 cancels out. And what do we have as a coefficient for, sorry, don't look at that. What do we have as a coefficient for the weight-height ratio? Beta 3? Oh, in fact, well, we don't need to know the number. It's just beta 3. So I'm actually just going through the exercise of interpreting the coefficients. Are you with me? If you fix gender, and if you say, let's look among individuals who are younger in age, where age 45 is 0, then this cancels out. Actually, we don't have to worry about age, but what we're interested in is that when we look at the relationship between log odds and weight height, it's not weight height, it's waist-hip ratio, then that slope is equal to beta 3. What happens for the older group? In that group, age 45 is equal to 1, so this will be 1. So now, what's the coefficient for the waist-hip ratio? It's beta 3 plus beta 4. So this slope is beta 3 plus beta 4. So what's beta 4? It's the difference in those two slopes. But when you talk about slopes with log odds, beta 3 is going to be the log of the odds ratio that relates diabetes to waist-hip ratio, but this will be in the subgroup of who? The older age group, where age 45 is 1, yes? And beta 3 plus beta 4 is going to be the log of the odds ratio that's looking at the relationship between the log odds of diabetes and waist-hip ratio, but among those for whom age 45 is 0, the younger group, yeah, I've done it backwards. Thank you. I've done it backwards. So when age 45 is 1, the slope is beta 3 plus beta 4. Thank you, Rachel, for pointing that out. When age is equal to 0, that last term cancels out, and this slope is equal to beta 3. So I have gotten this backwards, but we'll just erase it so we can talk about the younger group and the older group. And then we can say, what's beta 4 by itself, right? What's beta 4 by itself? So beta 4 is a difference between two log odds ratios. So if I can say beta 4 is a difference between two log odds ratios, which, would you agree with me, it's a difference between two log odds ratios? Do you agree with me? Then that's the same as saying it's the log of the ratio of those two odds ratios. So what do we have? Do we have a difference in the change in log odds of diabetes with each increase of 1 centimeter in waist-hip ratio between older and younger individuals controlling for gender? So is it a difference in the change in log odds? So we're asked to exponentiate this. So we're not going to be on a log odds scale. So A is false. Is it the factor by which the odds ratio for the association of diabetes and waist ratio is decreased in older individuals versus younger individuals controlling for gender? That's sounding pretty possible. Is it a change in log odds? No, it's not a change in log odds. Is it a difference between males and females in the odds ratio for diabetes and increasing age controlling for waist-hip ratio? It's not a difference by gender. We're controlling for gender. Is it a difference between older and younger individuals in log odds ratio? So it's not a difference in log odds or log odds ratios. If you've exponentiated this beta 4, it's just going to be a ratio of two odds ratios. And that's why the answer here is B, the factor by which the odds in one group is different from the odds in the other group, meaning the older age group compared to the younger age group. Question?
I'm just wondering, the interaction term, is it always going to be one dichotomous?
It's not. So with it, the question was, in an interaction term, you may have two continuous variables. It makes it harder to interpret. So if you have, so we often try to have examples where you have age dichotomized so you can make more sense of it, making a comparison between one group and the other. If you have two continuous ones, you have to worry about the double interpretation of saying the change in per unit in one group with each increasing unit in the other. There's more of a difficulty in interpretation. Yes. Well, when you have an interaction with two dichotomous variables, which is what we don't have here, we have one dichotomous and one continuous. When it's two dichotomous ones, then we can equivalently look at, is there an effect modification, you know, of one on the relationship between the second one and the outcome or the other? It is reversible. So, you know, scientifically, we would want to know which one is the effect modifier based on what we have in terms of the underlying scientific knowledge. But if we had two dichotomous ones, we can certainly interpret them in either direction. Sure. So what I was trying to do when we showed this was to say that we're able to say that beta 3 on its own is going to be a log odds ratio. And beta 3 plus beta 4 is a log odds ratio. So, and a log odds ratio is a difference between two log odds or a change in log odds. But what we're asked in this question is to go beyond the subtraction to give us what beta 4 is, which is a log of a difference between two log odds ratios. So beta 4, if you look down at these two definitions for older and younger individuals, beta 4 is a difference between two log odds ratios. One in the log odds ratio of the diabetes waist height, waist hip ratio in older people, that's the age 45 plus, minus the log of the odds ratio for diabetes waist hip ratio in the 45, less than 45 group. So that difference in two log odds ratios is the same as the log of the ratio of those. So let me do this as an example. Okay. Okay, so in terms of the wording, when we're asked then to exponentiate beta 4, which was a log of a ratio of two odds ratios, e to the beta 4 is going to be just giving us an odds ratio divided by an odds ratio. So that ratio of two odds ratio is either going to equal 1, or it's going to be greater than 1, or less than 1. So that is why if there's no interaction, those two odds ratios will actually be the same, and beta 4 would be 0, which means e to the beta 4 is equal to 1, meaning no difference in the relationship between log odds of diabetes and waist hip ratio by age. The wording of A is that it says the difference in the change in log odds. So the fact that we have exponentiated so that we're not talking about log of anything, we're talking about looking at one odds ratio divided by another one. The wording of log odds in any of these would lead us to say, you know, these are not appropriate conclusions. And the other ones we ruled out D because we're not looking at females versus males. C had the word log odds in it. And so by process of elimination, even, we could come down to the factor by which the odds ratio for this association is either increased or decreased. If this factor was equal to 1, it would say the odds ratio is the same in the older age group as it is in the younger age group. And so, you know, so any of these that say log odds or odds ratio are incorrect because we have exponentiated this. Moving on to 12. Okay, new question. Suppose in question 12 that a case control study was created from this data set by using the 75 diabetes cases and the and then identifying one non-diabetes individual. Here's the key. What does it say? Of the same age, gender, and waist-hip ratio for each case. Then of interest is the relationship between high systolic blood pressure and diabetes. So now we also look at this table, which displays the data. So this is set up in a format where it's not looking at cases and controls in two columns. Rather, it's looking at cases with diabetes, high blood pressure, low, and controls without diabetes, high versus low, so that we can see just by the way the data are displayed, as well as the description of the study design, that these are pairs of cases and controls. So this is a paired study design. And that each of these is referring to 18 pairs of cases with diabetes who have high systolic blood pressure matched to controls without diabetes who also have high blood pressure. And if you think about these in terms of discordant and concordant pairs with respect to their exposure, the groups of interest would be the 27 cases with high and controls with low blood pressure, and the 7 cases with low blood pressure matched to controls with high blood pressure. Okay, so based on that, which of the following is the best conclusion about the association between diabetes and systolic blood pressure among individuals of the same age, gender, and waist to hip ratio? So this looks like this is, the test that one could do in one's head that Armitage and Berry said. It's since it's paired, so it's B minus C squared over B plus C. And so we really just have 27 minus 7 squared over 27 plus 7. So it's 20 squared over 34, which looks like it's something like 4,000 over 34. That's looking about right. Maybe not. Who knows? 20. Maybe 400 over 34. And I get about 11.76 or 11.8. How many degrees of freedom? 1. Far above 3.84. So it looks like there's a statistically significant association. And what is it telling us? That there are more pairs in which cases have high blood pressure and controls do not, compared to the number of pairs in which cases have low blood pressure but controls have high blood pressure. So, is there a statistically significantly increased odds of high systolic blood pressure in controls? No. And it's not going to be a Z-test that we're looking. Is there no statistically significant difference? No. There is no statistically difference? No. So we're coming down to D. There is a statistically significantly increased odds of high systolic blood pressure in cases as compared to controls with this McNamara test statistic of 11.76. I'll place my money on that. Hopefully you do too. And E, there is not sufficient data available to make a conclusion. There are, so we'll get rid of that one. Okay. So maybe a common error on that one was to not take into account the paired design and to calculate a Z or a chi-square statistic.
What was that formula again?
Well, this was the McNamara's test. And if we look back, it is on the formula sheet. It's looking for the matched pair study design in which B and C are the discordant pairs with respect to exposure. So if we looked on the formula pages.
I may be totally missing it, but I don't know.
Is it really not there?
It is.
Okay. So what we have on the, and actually it's on the very first page of the formula page. This is page 19, right? Page 19. It shows that you have the odds ratio estimate of B over C sort of here in the middle of the right-hand side of the page, and then it has the corresponding standard error and the McNamara's test statistic that goes along with it. Okay, and then 13 through 20 are going to look at a different data set. It concerns heart-lung transplantation. In transplantation, the quality of the match between donor and recipient affects the success of the transplant and subsequently the survival time. So researchers hope to develop what they're calling a mismatch score to characterize the quality of the match by blood type, tissue type, antibody presence or absence to better predict survival time following transplant. So they have a pilot study. They've done a historical chart review. In their data set, survival times are observed completely. In other words, each patient is observed until his or her death. And then we have some data in terms of models and figures that are given at the end of the exam. So number 13 is saying that the researchers believe that they will obtain approximately 40 charts. So that to me sounds like the overall N. Overall N is equal to 40. Based on their prior experience, they estimate that the standard deviation of survival times is 300 days. So what does that sound like to you? Sigma, right? So for this continuous survival time is 300 days. Approximately what will be their interval width to estimate, keywords, interval width, width meaning two times the half width of an interval, meaning we're going to look for a 95% confidence interval. And we're estimating the difference in mean survival times between persons with mismatched scores above and below the median. So what do we want? We want a 95% confidence interval for the true difference in average survival time in one group minus the other. And we know that the standard deviation is assumed to be sigma. And we're asked to look at this with respect to persons with mismatched scores above and below the median. So if you have two groups above and below the median and your total number, their total number is 40, how many are above the median and how many are below the median? Right? So you'd have N1 equals N2 equals a group of 20 in both groups for a total overall of 40. Make sense? Now we have to say, what's the half width of this interval? So if we were creating a 95% confidence interval, we would have taken the difference in the two means. But what's the half width? What are we adding? 1.96 times sigma squared over N1 plus sigma squared over N2, assuming what about standard deviation? That it's the same. So we're not given any other information about differences in standard deviation. So D, which is the half width of this confidence interval for the true difference in means, is what is 1.96. And we'll use the standard error of the difference in means. So it would be 300 squared over 20 plus 300 squared over 20. Now, how did I know that that was the standard error of the difference between two means? How did I know? When I maybe do a little bit of a double checking, if I was hesitating, I would go back to my formula sheet, which I'm doing right now. I'm trying to look for my formula sheet. And I remember that this is a two-sample case, below the median, above the median, and I can see that the standard error for the difference in means is always going to be the denominator of the test statistic. So this allows me to just verify that that's the standard error that I want. So using that, I will go back to that question and say I'm very certain that that's what I want to use. 300 squared over 20 plus 300 squared over 20, and that will give us the half width of the confidence interval. So I'd have to go through a little bit of calculation, not too much, 2 times 300 squared. Are you with me? Right? So I'm just going to look at this. And if I've not done this too quickly, I'm getting about 186 as the half width. And so what would be the width of that confidence interval? 2 times this. which is about 372. So the closest would be about 380. And there's a big spread in these responses, so that, you know, it's not close to 270, it's not close to 600. Okay. So the key here was to recognize you were told that sigma was 300. The key was also to recognize that if you split above and below the median, that N1 would be 20 and N2 would be 20. And then we're estimating, because we're estimating the interval width, so we're using our confidence interval construction. Any questions? Move on. Okay. Move on. 14 says that researchers actually end up reviewing 39 charts, and they proceed to regress survival time onto a mismatch score that ranges between 0 to 3.05, where higher scores are a worse match. And they have a simple linear regression of this that's in Model E on page 11. And it also says then that figure 1 on page 13 displays the data overlaid by a fitted regression line and prediction intervals. Now, this is a question that was meant to differentiate between confidence intervals for a mean value and prediction intervals for an individual. Do you remember that distinction where there was one added, there was a value of one added under the square root of the standard error term? In fact, if you go back to the last pages of the formula sheet, the very last page, or maybe not, I take that back. It's not on the formula page. But the difference was that there was an added one to a prediction interval. So if anything, we know prediction intervals are going to be wider than confidence intervals, and prediction intervals are for the predicted value of an individual, as opposed to a confidence interval is for the mean or the average. So with that in mind, if you were told that when you looked at that figure, you saw a mismatch score of 1.2 is associated with a prediction interval between negative 452 and 912, what would be the appropriate interpretation? So this was a bit of a stretch question to get you thinking about confidence interval versus prediction interval, but because it's for an individual, all of the ones that say confidence intervals or talking about covering the population mean or the mean survival time are not going to be appropriate, because those would be interpretations of confidence intervals, not of prediction intervals. And we see this prediction interval is quite wide. So let's look at the ones that might make more sense then. 95% of individuals with mismatch score of 1.2 are forecast to have survival times between negative 452 and 912. Let's look at the other option. 95% of survival time means for populations with mismatch score of 1.2 are estimated to fall between negative 452 and 912. So because this is talking about means for populations, again, our attention on this somewhat difficult question would be that the answer is A, because it's talking about predictions for individuals as opposed to a confidence interval, which is talking about coverage for a mean. So this was a stretch question a bit, but the difference was prediction for an individual, confidence interval for a mean value. So why don't we move on to 15, which says if the researcher centered mismatch scores at the median and refit that regression model from Model E, what would the intercept estimate be? Okay, so if we fit this at the median, we'd say, actually now, so should we look at Model E and just write that out very quickly? Model E is the estimated the expected survival time as a function of just the mismatch score. And so now we're saying, suppose you have a new model where you center, so you have survival time, and it's equal to beta naught now plus beta 1 times mismatch, but it's centered at the value of 1.30. Okay, so beta 1 doesn't change, the intercept changes, and so if you look back at a graph, should we do that? How would you like to do this? You can do it in a couple of different ways. Want to look at a graph?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So the graph is back here behind model G. Okay, so here's the survival times. What are we saying we're centering at? A mismatch score of 1. What was it again? 0.3. So it looks like here's about 1.5, so 1.3. So if we looked at this fitted regression line, I'd say that now the... Oh, sorry. Okay, so here's 1.13. So now I'm going to extrapolate up. So it looks to me like the new beta naught from that centered regression is going to be the estimated survival time when mismatch score is about 1.13. And what would you estimate that to be? So it's going to be somewhere that's about 250 or so. It's in between 0 and 500. So let's go back and see if there's a response that looks similar. And that's right. Bhakti says it's going to be exactly. So here we are. So it's not going to be 0. It's not going to be 100. It's not going to be 451. Did it look like it was above 250? I don't think so. So it would be 230, 237. The other way to do this is that we know that beta 1 doesn't change. So another way to do this is we would have taken the original beta naught and we would have subtracted beta 1 times, well, we take plus beta 1 times negative 1.30. So we would have been able to actually calculate that new estimated intercept if we had wanted to, but our idea was just to extrapolate it from the graph. Just extrapolate it from the graph, Bhakti.
Why is it negative?
The reason is because remember when we're centering, we're subtracting 1.13. So if I wrote this out, I'd write it out as beta naught plus beta 1 times mismatch minus beta 1 times negative 1.30. And so if I was to do it that way, I'd have to plug in the estimated B0 and B1 from the original model, and then that should lead me to, as well, 237 days. This is just algebra. I'm just taking beta 1 and multiplying it by mismatch minus 1.13, so it's beta 1 times mismatch minus 1.13 times beta 1. Okay, just a few more questions. So here these researchers are still trying to find this best mismatch score to go along with predicting survival. And disappointed with the performance of their score, they explore whether the mismatch score may be important after accounting for another variable, which is transplant rejection. So model F is a regression model that adds reject one if the initial transplant was rejected, zero otherwise, as a second predictor. And then model G has these two predictors plus a term that codes their interaction. So based on models E through G, does the magnitude of the linear association between survival time and mismatch score statistically significantly differ between persons who reject their initial transplant and those who don't? So Which of these models would answer the question? Does the magnitude of the linear relationship between survival and mismatch differ between groups who initially rejected versus not? This is sounding very ANCOVA-like. It's really saying here's survival time, here's mismatch score. We want to know if the linear association between those two differs statistically. So we would be testing an interaction term. So to answer that question about whether the slope that relates survival time with mismatch differs between rejection and non-rejection, we would have to go to the model which has the interaction term in it. Okay, Model E has only mismatch. Model F has mismatch and rejection. I could have asked a different question. The question could have said, after you account for rejection status, is there a statistically significant difference by mismatch score? Is there a statistically significant association between survival time and mismatch score? That's a different question. Yes, okay, so we'll look at that in 17. Model G is saying we've brought in the interaction term, so we're asking, is there a different relationship between survival time and mismatch score by level of transplant? Yes? That's what we're looking at. So we want to test whether this coefficient beta 3 equals 0. Let's look at the coefficient. It's negative 145, but it has a t-statistic of negative 0.91, p-value of 0.367. So when we're testing whether beta 3 is equal to 0, what's our conclusion? No. Oh, I'd say this is a pretty non-positive, you know, this is non-statistically significant. It's not close to 0.05. It's not 0.07 or 0.1. So we would say probably we'd be happy with saying there's not a difference. Let's go back to the model in which we'd assume the same relationship. So based on that interaction coefficient from Model G, our answer to 16 is there a statistically significant difference between those slopes? Our answer is no. So we got rid of one of these. Is it because the interaction coefficient in Model G does not statistically significantly differ from zero? I'd go with that one. So if you have an interaction term, we're not interested in looking at the reject coefficient on its own. We're interested in looking at the interaction coefficient. And these other ones that are talking about Model F are from just regular multiple linear regressions that are adjusting for the other variable.
Yes.
Yes. Right, so I'm going back to Model G, and I see the estimated coefficient is a very large number, but then we compare it to its standard error. And so the t-statistic is setting up a t-statistic that takes B3 minus the hypothesized value of 0, divides by the standard error, and we get a very small t-statistic of negative 0.91 that has a p-value of 0.367 associated with it. So, see, it's not the magnitude of the coefficient itself, it's how it compares to its standard error in this t-statistic. So I think another way of looking at it is look at the 95% confidence interval on that coefficient. It's huge, right? It goes from negative 467 up to positive 177, overlaps zero. So because of this, I would say this is a non-statistically significant interaction, and we may as well go back to a simpler model, which would be Model F. So let's look at number 17. Number 17 says, interpret the mismatch coefficient in Model F. So here we go. Model F was our regular old multiple linear regression. We were looking at beta naught plus beta 1 mismatch plus beta 2 reject. So this is, if we wanted to, we could say the y-axis is survival time. I'm drawing the mismatch score, which we know is continuous, on the x-axis. And then reject, remember, is dichotomous. So our interpretation of beta 1 is that this is the change in the expected survival time per unit change in mismatch score. Per unit change in mismatch score. That's what our beta 1 would be, change in expected outcome per unit change in mismatch score. But what are we doing? We're adjusting for or holding fixed the value of reject. So it's saying among individuals who have the same rejection status, transplant rejection status, then this slope, which is actually negative, so it says once you control for rejection status, the survival time is decreasing by 132 days per unit mismatch score. Is it statistically significant? No, but our interpretation is that this slope, whether you're looking among those with a rejection status of 1 or a rejection status of 0, that slope is going to be equal to beta 1. So when we interpret number 17, our interpretation is among those individuals who of the same rejection status, so we can go through each of these in turn. This one says, among persons who do not reject their initial transplants. Well, we could only look at that if we had included the interaction term, so we could look at just the rejected individuals versus the non-initial rejections. So this one's not appropriate. How about comparing persons of the same rejection status? Those with a given mismatch score are estimated to have a mean survival 133 days lower than those with a 1 point less mismatch score. It's another way of saying with comparing those that differ by one unit on their mismatch score. So I think this is sounding pretty good. Irrespective of rejection status, those with a given mismatch score are estimated to have a mean survival 133 days lower than those with a 1 point less mismatch score. You know what? Yeah, let's look at B and C because there is a difference. And I circled B, but let's look at. So when we say comparing persons of the same rejection status, those with a given mismatch score are estimated to have this survival 133 days lower than those with a 1 point less mismatch versus the wording that says irrespective of rejection status, those with a given mismatch score are estimated to have a mean survival 133 days lower than those with a 1 point less mismatch score. So it's different wording. It's different wording. Yes. So when it says irrespective, meaning another maybe better word would have been to say ignoring rejection status, then we would have had model E, which is just looking at mismatch score. But if we actually include rejection status in the model, which is what model F is doing, then our answer would be when you have individuals of the same rejection status, the coefficient for mismatch is looking at the change in expected or mean survival time with one unit increase in mismatch score. And then D, among persons with mismatch score of 0, is nonsensical. And then the difference in mean survival time between those rejecting versus not rejecting, that would tend to be, that first part would tend to be the coefficient for rejection, which is not what is being asked for. Okay. Sound good? So 18 says, figure 2 shows the residuals versus mismatch score plot using an RVP. So remember, this is the residuals versus predicted plot, where the predictor is here going to be mismatch. So it's the residuals versus mismatch score. We're hoping it's going to be sort of a random scatter around 0. That's our goal. It says now we can see that the points are coded differently by the level of the reject variable. Which of the following is the appropriate interpretation based on this plot? So we're going to look at figure 2. So here comes figure 2. Figure 2 has the residuals, so this is y minus y hat from model E. We have the mismatch score, which is this x variable predictor, and we see that the line is drawn for where we have residuals equal to 0. And what we're hoping to see is just random scatter, equal random scatter around this line that is y equals 0. And what do you notice? And remember, 1 is rejection, initial transplant rejection, and zeros are no initial transplant rejection. So does it look like random scatter? No. You see a lot of 1s above 0, not many zeros. Do you see some patterns emerging that don't seem to be random? Do you see equidistant scatter above 0 and below 0? No. So all of these would lead us to say that something's going on that's violating the assumptions. What about equal variance? So do you see the same spread across levels of mismatch score? So it sort of actually looks like the variability is decreasing with increasing mismatch score. And because they're not centered at 0, it seems like this is a skewed or non-normal distribution. So our question in number 18 was, let's go back and see what our question was asking. So what can we say is an appropriate interpretation? Am I looking at the right figure? Good. Okay. So A says the precision of prediction has been substantially improved compared to the simple linear regression. Does this figure say anything about that? So A has nothing to do with our interpretation of this figure. Does the multiple linear assumption of independence appear to be violated? We can't tell from the figure. Remember, that depends on how the data are collected. It depends on the study design. How about C, the multiple linear assumptions of equal variance and normal distribution appear to be violated? I'd go with this one, but let's keep going. The multiple linear regression assumptions appear to be reasonably met. No, we don't see random scatter. We don't see equal variance. And the mean survival times differ significantly by at least 1 of mismatch score and rejection status. What does that mean? Okay, so the answer here would be C. These 2 assumptions of equal variance and normal distribution appear to be violated. Okay, 2 more questions. And that is that a colleague says, actually, why don't you repeat your analysis to try to see if the assumptions might hold better if the log of the survival time was used rather than survival time itself? And so if a multiple linear regression of log survival time on those 2 variables of mismatch score and reject status are shown in model H and the residuals are shown in figure 3, what are the appropriate conclusions from model H considering only those findings supported by statistical inference? So we want to go look at the findings that can be supported by statistical inference from model H. So here we can see Stata is generating the log of survival time. We're regressing log onto mismatch and rejection. And then we can see that our estimated coefficients are B1, B2, B0. And here are the p-values that go along with testing a hypothesis that the corresponding beta, I'll just call it beta J, equals 0, and then the 95% confidence intervals for those particular true population coefficients. Okay, so considering that we'd set conventionally alpha equal to 0.05, right, without being told otherwise, what would you say? So the mismatch coefficient is sort of marginally significant, not significant at the 0.05 level. We do see a statistically significant association by reject status after controlling for mismatch. So that's the one I would go with. The association between log survival time and mismatch is not statistically significant after controlling for rejection status, but rejection status is significant after controlling for mismatch. So I'm hoping that we have some answers that look something like that. So if we go to 19, higher mismatch scores are associated with shortened log survival times, but this association is modified by rejection status. We can't assess that because we don't have an interaction term, right? We need an interaction term. Either a mismatch score or rejection status is associated with shortened log survival time, but post-hoc analyses are needed to determine which one. Should we put one in? Which one? We don't need to do post-hoc. We have those two T statistics and confidence intervals. So transplant rejection is associated with shortened survival time, holding mismatch score constant. Now, we just want to make sure. Is it shortened log survival time? We have to look at the coefficient, don't we? Is it shortened? Looks like it's increased to me. I think it's increased. So go back to 19. So is it shortened or lengthened? So I'm going to go with it's associated with lengthened log survival time, holding mismatch score constant, that's D, and we would not say that neither one is predictive of log survival time because we do see the statistically significant association with the rejection covariate. Okay, well, you've hung in with me this whole time. Now we're on number 20, last one. Based on all the evidence you have to consider, how should the researchers be advised in contrasting and interpreting the model that had the multiple linear regression with original survival time and then model H, which had the multiple linear regression with two covariates, mismatch and rejection, with log survival time? So we're really trying to say, what do you think? Which would you go with, with F versus H, and why? So we had two figures. So I'm going to go to the figures first, and then if you want to go to something else after that, you can. But figure one is not the one we want to look at. Figure two is the one that's looking at the residuals versus predictors for model F. Figure three is looking at the residuals versus predictors for model H. And are you pleased with what you see in figure three? Yes. And so you're pleased. Why are you pleased? So you're seeing it's more what you'd expect, some random scatter. There's sort of equidistant plots, points above the line where y equals zero and below. There's no patterns. Looks like there's somewhat equal variance. So it looks like the assumptions for linear regression are better met with model H than with model F. So if we go back to this last question, number 20, the models are consistent with each other and either can equally well be reported. I would say false. Model F is the more trustworthy because it better satisfies the MLR assumptions. False. Model F is the more trustworthy because its results are conservative. What? False. Model H is the more trustworthy because it provides a significant result. Never believe that. Model H is the more trustworthy because it better satisfies the multiple linear regression assumptions. So that answer would be it. So this is the end. You're welcome. So if you have any other questions, I'm still here. But otherwise, hopefully this helps shake out some of the cobwebs from the past month. And then we will just continue to review this material, both with multiple linear regression expansion, and we'll continue with multiple logistic regression and carry it on to two more generalized linear models as well. Okay, everybody, have a good evening.